This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. If this dark cloud of a recession has a silver lining, perhaps it is a renewed sense of urgency to address the world's looming problems. President Obama talked about this pressing need in January's State of the Union address, calling it our generation's Sputnik moment. Here in Chapel Hill, academics and entrepreneurs are pioneering paths they believe will change the world. Heading up UNC's effort is Chancellor Holden Thorpe. His success as not only a chemistry professor, but also an innovator and businessman, provides an example of the new academic entrepreneurship. Also at the forefront of this wave of innovation is Buck Goldstein. He's a lawyer, social activist, businessman, and venture capitalist. He's also a professor in the practice of entrepreneurship at UNC. Together, Thorpe and Goldstein have written a book that outlines their vision for the changing world. Engines of Innovation, the Entrepreneurial University of the 21st Century. The book has been praised in academic circles, and we understand President Obama has given it a read. I'm pleased to have Holden Thorpe and Buck Goldstein in the studio now to talk about the future. Welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. It's great to be here.
Good to have you. Let's start by defining our terms. What do we mean when we say entrepreneur? What are we talking about, Holden Thorpe?
Well, I think that first thing we want to do is get people to really broaden their view of what they think of when they think of entrepreneur. A lot of people think an entrepreneur is somebody who starts a business in the commercial sector that is solely focused on profits. But we believe that by broadening the definition into what people have more recently called social entrepreneurship, it's possible to use the concept of the entrepreneur to embrace the entire university, so that rather than thinking of the entrepreneurs in the university as just being a few science professors who are starting venture-backed companies, you can think of everyone in the university having an opportunity to be entrepreneurial.
But how does that work in the real world? I mean, in the university, how would things change?
Well, for example, the universities have, and ours certainly has been well known for this. Universities have been enacting social change for 500 years. The North Carolina Memorial Hospital was, you could say, a social entrepreneurship project, and the School of Government, and all of these things that Carolina has been so well known for. And if you look back at the people who did those things, and then you compare them to a commercial entrepreneur, there's a lot of similarities. Because you have to figure out how something's going to become sustained, how people are going to access it, and what the value proposition is.
Buck Goldstein, let's talk about that as a venture capitalist among your many hats that you wear. That is important on the business side of this, not on the social agenda. But when it comes to figuring out how to sustain itself, it has to be able to make a profit.
Well, profit making is only one part of the equation. And there are really two elements here. First, innovation doesn't have to be for profit, but the line between for profit and nonprofit is getting increasingly blurry. So very often, enterprises choose to be a for profit. For instance, we had the founder of Stonyfield Yogurt come talk, Gary Hirschberg, and he's built a very large, very exciting company that's probably having a more positive impact on the environment than the Sierra Club. And he said, you know, I'm going to spend most of my time in the for-profit sector trying to change the world. So the notion that for-profit is not a change agent and that nonprofit is by definition a change agent is kind of changing right now. And a few people over the years, the last 5 years, have helped educate us about that, that that's really a distinction that's going away.
So in terms of organizing departments and the way a university is set up, would a university that embraced these principles look any different, Holden Thorpe?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, we talk a lot in our book about how we believe that this is more of a cultural change than a structural change. I mean, you can put the boxes on the org chart wherever you want, and you're not going to really create a lot of entrepreneurs. But if you create an environment where this sort of thing is valued and where the resources to do it well are available, then you have an opportunity to get more impact from the knowledge that you create and the talent that you produce. And, you know, I think David Brooks wrote a column that was out also the day of the State of the Union address called The Talent Magnet, where he was putting forward the universities as a model for American competitiveness, because we do two things. We create an environment where important ideas can be formed and where things can be done, and then we attract talent to that environment. And that's what America needs to do to compete in a globalized world. And so we really think that it's more about the conversation that is going on and the things that people perceive are valued by the institution more than it is, you know, we don't have a vice chancellor for entrepreneurship. We don't have a department of entrepreneurship, and we're not going to have those things.
So, well, Frank, yeah. It's also, I think, to sum up this whole thing about entrepreneurship, it's a way of thinking. So it's a way of thinking that says what some people see as a problem, entrepreneurs see as an opportunity. And they gravitate toward problems, and they are willing to take some risk. And that's not hasn't always been the case at universities, but when you create a culture that isn't risk adverse and that welcomes problems as opportunities, then you have the sort of basic foundation that lets all these things happen.
Now, why is this the role of the university? Why should universities take on these risks and these problems, challenges?
Well, if you look at some of the things that the university has to offer, I mean, universities have been around for 500 years. We say in the book that most of the institutions that have been around that long are universities. Even though our budgets are stressed right now because of problems with state government and possibly with the federal government, we still have billions and billions of dollars of financial resources. We have young people at the most innovative and formative period of their life, and we have unbelievable talent that we have attracted. So if you look at a problem, you know, what other institutions are there that can be around for 20 or 30 years that it takes to solve a problem that can bring energetic talent to it? And, you know, I just got back from visiting our AIDS clinic in Malawi, where our researchers have been able to bring the incidence that a mother would transmit HIV to her baby almost to zero. And in order for us to do that, we had to be there for 20 years. And what other institution is there that could go to a place like Malawi and set up a clinic and have people who would sustain it for 20 years?
Well, then it sounds like this kind of thing is already going on. What needs to change?
Well, it's the culture, and that's what Holden said before. So the good news is universities have been around a long time. 70 of the 85 institutions that existed in 1550 and still exist are universities. So long time horizon. Well, there's a reason for that. They're slow to change. And so part of this is a culture that frankly starts at the top and says it's okay to make a mistake.
Is this a culture in the universities or the culture on Wall Street? Because it seems to me that Wall Street is the place where there's no patience for anything beyond this quarter in terms of turning a profit. The idea that you could spend 4, 5, 6, 7, 10, 500 years solving a problem to Wall Street is unthinkable.
Right. So, and they are also very impatient with us because they think it's taking way too long to get innovation out the door. And that's the sort of magic, is that there are things within this community that there's no other institution in our society capable of doing. A corporate structure, you put your finger right on it. Can't do it because they have such a narrow time horizon and limited resources. Holden and I were talking to John Hennessy, who's the president of Stanford, in a hotel in Washington, and his bottom line was, look, if we don't do it, if universities don't do it, who is going to do it? There isn't any other institution, Wall Street, corporate America, that will attack these problems the way universities can.
So give us an example of how this culture change would look. What would happen? Does that mean that I train a researcher not only to do the research and work in the lab and be patient and waiting for the results, but also how to turn that into a business? That's all part of the university's job now?
Yes. Well, if you're a scientist who has an idea that can produce an innovation that would help people or create economic activity, then right now there's probably a better chance than anything that you would write that up and maybe somebody would pick it up and do something with it. But like a lot of things, if the person who invented the idea is not always the best person to help apply it, but more often than not, it's good to have the person who came up with the idea help you implement it. So what we want is a culture where somebody thinks oh, you know, I really could do something with this, but I don't really know how, and there's a lot of risk involved, and I'm not sure if my university thinks that it's worthwhile, so I'm going to just publish this and see if somebody takes it and does something with it. What we want is a culture where because the resources are there and because it's part of the conversation about the university, that instead someone would say, you know, maybe I'll help get this thing started. And one of the ways that we think we can make a big change on that is to do essentially what Buck and I have done, which is to welcome venture capitalists and successful entrepreneurs into the university, have them participate in our teaching, have them hanging around in the departments so that when I have an idea and I think, well, I'm going to need to know a business person in order to do this, I don't have to meet one for the very first time because there's one working down the hall for me.
On the State of Things today, we're talking about new entrepreneurial roles for universities. My guest, Holden Thorpe, Chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill. Buck Goldstein is a professor of entrepreneurship at UNC. Just ahead, we'll look at some examples of where this might be already taking place and how to jibe university traditions with the future. All that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. On the State of Things today, talking about the new entrepreneurial role for universities, my guest Holden Thorpe, Chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill, and Buck Goldstein is a professor of entrepreneurship at UNC. Together, they've written a book, Engines of Innovation, the Entrepreneurial University of the 21st Century. And in the book, you cite the example of Joe DeSimone, who's now teaching chemistry at UNC. Almost didn't get the job, but he did. Tell us his story and how he fits your model and your vision of what the new role might be.
Right. Well, a scientist like Joe has a lot of great ideas and also a pretty good awareness of what the applications of his ideas are. And as we say in the book, not every faculty member is going to bring all those traits. But when they do, we want to make sure that Carolina is a place where they can succeed. So Joe has had a number of ventures. The first one was in cleaning. He worked out a way to use carbon dioxide in cleaning, and now he's got a way to make very uniform particles for use in medicine. And he started businesses with both of those things and several others. And one of the points that Joe makes that I think is important is that his awareness of the outside world and the private sector and the things that are commercially applicable helps him propose more interesting basic research questions. So Joe talks about how he likes it when he does something that produces a patent and also a paper in a prestigious journal and also helps him get an NIH grant. And, you know, not everybody is going to do things that are susceptible to that kind of thinking. But the ones that do, we want to make sure that Carolina is a great environment for them.
So when I first arrived, six years ago, and wasn't quite sure what I was going to be doing, talked to a few people. Probably the first two people who called me were Joe DeSimone and Holden Thorpe and said, hey, come over. I want to talk to you about something, an idea. So immediately we began to see, hey, there's something here because people are looking for a way to expand the conversation and begin to talk to some people outside of their realm. And in retrospect, we didn't know it at the time, it probably wasn't just coincidence that you two were the first two people to call.
And tell me a little bit about what you do on campus when you're not answering phone calls about good ideas.
So I teach. I get a chance to teach 100 students a year who are major in something real, like physics or chemistry or music or art or history or English, and who can minor in entrepreneurship. And what we try to do is to teach them the basic tools that are required to make an idea into a reality. And it doesn't matter if it's a commercial idea, a scientific or a social entrepreneurship idea, the basic principles are the same. They learn a little bit about strategy from Michael Porter. They learn a little bit about marketing. They learn a little bit about metrics and how do you measure success. And then they do an internship and they go out and because this is a contact sport. You've got to actually go out and do it. And they go out all over the world. We send 20 to Beijing every summer. And they work in Beijing with an emerging early stage company in China and come back. I always tell them you'll never go to Beijing for the first time. Usually pretty sobered about, but understand that China is going to be a big part of their life, whether they want that or not. And that's the drill, basically.
Yeah, and I think that the minor in entrepreneurship, as Buck just described it, is a great metaphor for how we're thinking about this and its impact on the whole university. We don't want kids to major in entrepreneurship. We want them to major in as Buck said, journalism and English and the traditional subjects. And we don't want to create a lot of new faculty members who are teaching in this. We just want the minor in entrepreneurship to give people an introduction to what it's like to control your own destiny and create something from scratch and not know whether it's going to succeed. And I think that we've done a great job of doing that for the students, and we just want to infuse that whole philosophy through as much of the university as we can.
Would the emphasis on entrepreneurship in any way undermine the notion of basic research, research more or less for its own sake?
Absolutely not. And in fact, most great entrepreneurial ventures, even if they're in the science area, are drawing on the hundreds of years of basic research that comes before. So the last thing we would want is for 20 years from now, somebody to have an idea that would depend on a piece of basic knowledge that's being generated now and for that not to be there. So that's, again, why we're not talking about a wholesale reorganization of the university or dramatically changing the curriculum. We're talking about just altering the conversation enough to nudge some of these things in the right direction.
But let me press you on this a little bit because I'm going to hear what you're saying. You're talking about making the opportunity available and not shifting the emphasis. But let's say everybody catches on to this idea and it works and it starts to generate some kind of revenue. I can envision down the road where this becomes the model and there's a time when somebody in the lab says, yeah, but I don't think it's going to fly, so I'm dropping this line of research for something that's more certain. And down the line, that good idea that would have taken time gets dropped in favor of something that looks more promising in the immediate future.
Well, I think, we've had the law that allows universities to keep the intellectual property rights to federally funded inventions, the Bayh-Dole Act, for 31 years now. And we haven't seen this wholesale change, even though at the time that law was passed, there were people who were saying about the university precisely what you're saying. So I don't think the danger of that wholesale change is very great. And furthermore, the federal government, in issuing its instructions for research funding, has repeated numerous times that basic research could be enhanced if we could realize more of the applications. And the Obama administration has been very clear about that and totally open about the fact that they could probably get us more support for basic research if we would apply more of the knowledge ourselves.
Just to support that, President Obama just this past week in his weekly radio address talked about that very thing. He was on location at an Intel computer plant in Portland, Oregon.
The truth is we have everything we need to compete. Bold entrepreneurs, bright new ideas, and world-class colleges and universities. Most of all, we have young people just brimming with promise and ready to help us succeed. All we have to do is tap that potential. That's the lesson on display here at Intel, and it's how America will win the future.
Now, is that all?
I just got to say, Saturday morning, I called up Buck and I said, you got to get over here and watch the president's radio address. You're not going to believe it.
Right. Yeah. It was like, we weren't sure if he read our book, but after listening to that, we thought maybe he had.
Well, is that all that has to happen, or are there rules in terms of donors and the way donors look at the university? Would that have to change?
Well, I don't think it has to change. I think that it's a welcome. If Holden spends a lot of his time dealing with that problem, arbitrating that problem, as we say, that's kind of a high-class problem to have. And if you look at on the hierarchy of problems, trying to decide, is the university having too big an impact on the world's biggest problems? You know, most college presidents would take that one as one to deal with. It isn't to say that you don't have to arbitrate. It isn't to say that you don't have to be protective of certain parts of the institution that are unique, because we don't have any other institutions like that. But the real truth is we don't really have a choice, that the public is not going to continue to fund universities at the level that it has, nor our alumni or anyone else, if we don't focus, at least in part, on impact. What kind of impact are we having on really big problems?
And that's why our approach to broaden the definition of entrepreneurship beyond just creating a small molecule for rheumatoid arthritis, for which there's an incredible commercial need, to include what are we going to do about poverty, and what are we going to do about hunger, and what are we going to do about human rights, and all of these bigger social questions. When you do that, then it doesn't just become about creating revenue and creating jobs in the private sector. It becomes about the work of the university. And, of course, universities have been doing this by writing about these kinds of problems and understanding them and training people who know about them. And we're just trying to take all of that and put it together and make it even more effective than it's been.
So if you talk about addressing poverty, if you talk about addressing hunger, now you're going to have to, if you have a business idea, it means the public sector is going to have to somehow embrace this. And if you're talking about a business, it's going to somehow have to be profitable. We've never thought about the profitable kind of social engineering or social justice kind of mission.
Well, actually, increasingly we have, and really that term social entrepreneurship, which 5 years ago was a new idea. I mean, I Googled it not long ago, and it was like 30 million hits or something. So it's an idea whose time has come, and people are beginning to, as I said earlier, see that the line between for-profit and non-profit is not nearly as bright as it used to be. So it's really about the ecosystem that exists around the university, and one of the things we focused on is in the book and are focusing on now in terms of policy is how do you encourage that whole ecosystem, including people inside, people who used to be at the university, venture capitalists, entrepreneurs, non-government organizations. And if you look at the great universities, there's usually a pretty complex ecosystem right around it. And it's mobilizing that whole ecosystem and rationalizing it that's the challenge.
Well, what's the difference between the ecosystem that you say has evolved mm-hmm. around these great universities when you say rationalize it? Doesn't the market rationalize it?
Well,
isn't that what's happening?
It wasn't always welcome. Even 5 years ago, when I thought about doing this, I spent 6 weeks in it just because I thought, does this make any sense at all? Is there anybody inside the university who's interested in having an entrepreneur in the university? And I was surprised at the openness, but I will tell you that where we are now compared to 5 years ago is a total sea change. The Harvard Alumni Review just did this long piece on how innovative Harvard is and how it's really going after big ideas. 5 years ago, it was much more like, let's keep this out. Let's keep the wall up. We don't want to sully ourselves and dirty our hands by getting involved in the surrounding ecosystem. So there has been a sea change in public perception, I think, both inside and outside the university.
But how has that changed the ecosystem? As you say, this thing emerged and evolved anyway. Why does this change have to take place and how would it look?
You mean the change that needs to go on inside the university?
You talked about rationalizing right. this ecosystem, but it's there. It evolved, and it evolved even in the absence of this welcome that you say, people weren't – they wanted to put up a wall.
Yeah, but there wasn't the kind of interaction where now there are people walking around. I mean, there's an entrepreneur in a residence in the medical school, and he's a doctor who started a couple of businesses. Okay? That's a big deal. That's really a big deal.
Right. And so we think that our three things are broadening the definition of entrepreneurship to include social impact, getting more entrepreneurs inside the university who can be the interpreter and who can introduce the academics to what the real challenges are on the outside, and then including this for our students, because the biggest impact that a university has by far is what its students do after they leave the university. And so we need to include that as part of the culture. And we think as those three things happen, that the outside world, and we're already seeing this from Washington, as you just played that clip, will start taking notice of the fact that we're doing this. And over time, the ecosystem will change. But I do have to say that the, you know, where we sit right now in the research triangle, I mean, it's called the research triangle because it's got three universities. And so this was an idea that was formed to some extent 50 years ago.
And these ideas, as you say, have already taken root in their own way. So we have these ecosystems going. You talked about the president taking note. Is there anything that has to happen at the policy level, either in Washington or in Raleigh, that would make all of this a lot easier?
Well, there are a lot of things, and Holden's on a number of boards, and I know we'll comment, but I think at a conceptually, there is a difference between spending and investing. And this is what's really being discussed in Washington right now. The Republicans say the Democrats are just calling investing spending. But we think investing means expecting a return. And as a shareholder, setting some criteria and some standards for what you're prepared to do as a shareholder or investor in order to get a return. We think that's very healthy. And that as increasingly government agencies and others are saying, if we're going to invest in research, if we're going to invest in the university, we need a return. And just 10 days ago in Washington, we were talking about what exactly should the criteria be. Should it be jobs created? Should it be companies created? Should it be knowledge created? But if it's an investment, investors are shareholders who expect a return.
And I think the other thing is recognizing that, you know, if you think about where new ideas are going to form and be applied, it's in the university campuses and the cities of America. So how do we grapple with the fact that, you know, I think that what Rick Florida and a lot of these people are talking about you know, where ideas are formed in cities and urban areas. And, you know, we're sitting here in the American Tobacco Complex, which is an embodiment of this very idea, because people sit outside and somebody from one company talks to somebody else, and that's where the ideas come from. How do we deal with that, given the fact that America's land plan isn't exactly organized for that? We've got cities and university campuses. Some of them are together. Some of them are far apart. And then we've got vast regions in between. How do we have a national economic strategy that takes advantage of the urban places we've got, where we've got people coming together to produce ideas, and leverages that into an economic strategy for the whole country?
Well, the other thing is the accountability that Buck was just talking about. How do you come to some agreement on what the standards are going to be? Classically, traditionally, the standard for measuring an investment was maximum return on that dollar investment. Now, if you're talking about social entrepreneurship, I think you're going to have to talk about a little slower growth in terms of monetary investment, but try to see the growth in other areas. Does that mean a culture change in the world around you?
Sure. Well, you know, some of it is how you define return. So increasingly, there's something called the triple bottom line, which says not just profit, but also the impact it has on the environment and the impact it has on the society around it. We're even now seeing some companies that are incorporating to be, I think it's called B corporations, mm-hmm. where they really look at all of those things. And then as Michael Porter's new article in the Harvard Business Review beginning to touch on that as well. So return is beginning to have a slightly different definition. And I think President Obama is kind of saying, and I think he said this, you've heard him say this now a number of times, meet us halfway here.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we need to mobilize ourselves to do this. And I think the other thing is that the for-profit motive is going to include, whether we force it or not, success of the region around where the companies that are trying to succeed are going to be. And again, you know, the RTP is an older example. American Tobacco is certainly one example. But when we think about Chapel Hill, you know, the only way we can think about the university succeeding is that if there are places where the talent that we're trying to attract want to live and they can go to good schools, and people think about universities thinking about this way. But for-profit businesses have to think about it too.
Great to talk with both of you. I appreciate having you on the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Great
Thank
to be
you.
Here.
My guests are Holden Thorpe, Chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill, and Buck Goldstein, Professor of Entrepreneurship at UNC, authors of Engines of Innovation, the Entrepreneurial University in the 21st Century. Just ahead, what the legend of the beast that terrorized 18th century France can teach us about myth-making. Stay tuned.